Good evening.
Good evening.
It's good to be here with all of you tonight. Thanks for being here, and I have many thank yous that I want to say, and of course I can't cover all of them, but I'll cover as many as I can. First, I want to thank everybody here for having me, in particular the folks that decided that this would be something worthwhile for them and inviting me, and I know that a lot of you have done a lot of work, as Jason mentioned, to make all of this possible, and certainly Jason himself. And kind of getting the word out there for this and on the radio show, all that stuff is excellent. I want to thank the Fords. I tell you, I have been spoiled at their place. They've been very nice to me, and I haven't had this measure of hospitality before, so I might just come back just to hang out. So I really appreciate everything that they have done and the kindness that they have shown and the interest that everybody here has taken after lessons to just sit and talk and ask questions and try and get plugged in. So many of you have traveled from so many different places to be here. And, of course, there are several of you, a lot of you, that have been here every day. And I know that's a challenge. I understand that that can be a challenge sometimes when, life is busy. So I really appreciate that. Tonight we want to talk about evangelizing Muslims, and I want to take some time to consider maybe how as Christians, how is it that we might be successful in teaching the gospel to someone who is Muslim? Understanding the basic tenets of the faith is important, and we've talked a little bit about some of the beliefs of Islam. And of course, we've looked at some of the different things as far as the miracles of Islam and kind of refuting those and a lot of different of the Muslim apologist views of how they might view Christianity and how we can kind of defend our faith, you might say, very simply. Well, tonight we'll consider maybe how is it that some more practical things, how is it that you engage in a Bible study with a Muslim? I think that's a question. That's a very good question, a very fair question. But I want to say that we have to understand many different things before we can really get there. Let me give you some thoughts that I have that I've already probably told most of you because you've been here. But there have been some views and some things that have certainly hurt our cause in trying to reach Muslims with the gospel. There have been maybe some claims by Christians in the past that might have been very abusive to an entire country and an entire people rather than just a few individuals, which we kind of covered with our perspective on radical Islam. And social media has really made this much larger. It's kind of fanned the flame of what people think and their fears because now we can look on social media and post anything with the snap of a finger. We can read anything with the snap of a finger. Everything is so close to us. We can just get it at our fingertips. And we've seen it amongst politicians as well. A lot of people have run on certain campaigns that, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. And sometimes that strikes fear into people's hearts when there doesn't need to be fear. The denominational world or maybe the casual follower of Christ in some cases has also hurt our cause a little bit. Some of the billboard that I mentioned to you of the denominational church in Jacksonville that said Jesus won't come back until all Muslims are extinct. That kind of hurts our cause when we try and consider reaching out to Muslims. As I mentioned, mainstream fear and hatred in the media is bad, and it's gotten and it's crept into the hearts and minds of brethren. So as far as I'm concerned, what people believe and what they don't believe outside of the Lord's church in terms of what they're afraid of, well, you can't fix everything. But I will say the people that ought to be standing in the gap is us. Now that much I do know. The Lord's church ought to be standing in the gap. We should not be filled with fear. We can't be filled with fear. I understand that these things haven't arisen and haven't manifested themselves without cause. There are many terrible things happening in the name of Islam. And I understand that. All of those things have maybe called all of us to and caused us to pause and consider, well, what is our task and can we really do this? I won't go too much further again on that subject because we've really already covered that in our perspective of radical Islam. Yet we're maybe feeling torn, and maybe you have this weekend have felt torn because you say, well, I've been pricked to the heart a little bit. You know, maybe my toes have been stepped on, or however you want to phrase that. Maybe you said, well, I understand that I need to be doing something. I understand that I need to be reaching out to these people. And at the same time, you're thinking about, well, but I'm scared because of what's been out there. How should Christians view Muslims? The question still remains, how should we view Muslims we might know, we might work with, we might live around? We've already covered the statistics. There's so many Muslims. And by 2030, it will more than double in our country, the population of Muslims. So we not only consider maybe how we should view Muslims, but more importantly, how is it that we're going to teach these people? I'm often asked how Christ would view a Muslim in our modern times, and we covered the Jesus dealing with the woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, as such a great example of two cultures that seemingly, according to the scriptures, have no dealing with each other. Just like our culture might not have any dealing with these Muslims. And of course, Jesus doesn't just deal with this woman. He gives her the most important message that she would ever hear. And imagine the life that was impacted and all the lives that would be impacted from that. So again, by this time in the series, you're probably convicted. Okay, Saif, listen, I want to study with a Muslim, but where do I find one? Again, maybe some practical ways that we can kind of go about this. We realize at this point, it sounds like a strange question, but a valid one. But of course, we actually understand that Muslims are they're literally everywhere. When we consider the statistics that we went through yesterday morning, they're everywhere. They're teachers in our schools. They're friends of our children's or classmates, fellow co-workers. They shop at Publix or, you know, Food Lion and Kroger. I don't know if they have Publix this far north. They're literally everywhere. You know, there's probably a mosque in the area. If there is a mosque, there is a Muslim. And several. I know there are some very big mosques in Tennessee. They're everywhere. So instead, we're probably more interested in understanding how we might gain a Bible study with a Muslim because we understand they actually exist amongst us. The first suggestion that I'll give you tonight is to look for people that I would call people of peace. People of peace. And what I mean by people of peace is people that are seeking and to live their lives and claim to live their lives for God. Or in this case, they might call him Allah. Don't let that throw you off. That's not an eight-armed person. That is the Arabic translation for God. Look for people that claim to live their lives that way. That could mean many things. Maybe there's a Muslim that you work with that goes out to pray five times a day, or maybe just once a day. Or maybe the Muslim that you work with that every Friday at the same time they seem to be gone, at the same time and for the same amount of time. They seem to be gone. Friday is the holy day at the mosque. Maybe someone that you know is fasting. I don't know why, but that person doesn't drink or eat anything while the sun is up for a month. Why don't they do that? It's an interesting diet plan. They might be fasting, probably are fasting. Look for people that observe these religious holidays, Ramadan, religious traditions. Maybe somebody who's going on a vacation. Maybe it's not really a vacation. Maybe it's their pilgrimage, their Hajj, their pilgrimage to go to the Kaaba. Maybe there's a Muslim that lives in your community and shops where you shop that do these things. Maybe that wear the hijab. We can consider a couple passages that I find interesting. In Acts chapter 2, verse 1, we find what I would call and what I have just mentioned, as people of peace, the day of Pentecost, think about that. In Acts chapter 2 and verse 1, when the day of Pentecost arrived, they were all together in one place, and suddenly there came from heaven a sound like a mighty rushing wind and filled the entire house where they were sitting, and divided tongues as a fire appeared to them and rested on each of them. And we know how this goes. But what we would see is a bunch of people gathering to observe a religious holiday. Those are what I would call, or I would consider, and I'm suggesting you tonight, people of peace. They're gathering to observe this holiday. We would see later in the chapter, after Peter's preaching, 3,000 souls were added to the Lord's church. Don't you find that interesting? You have people of peace all gathered in one area, these religious people, right? Were they Christians? And verse 1? No. Were they Christians in verse 5? No. Were they Christians at the end of the chapter? Yep. What happened? Well, you had people of peace, right? You had the gospel. Christians. I can give you a lot more examples, and I'm going to. Acts chapter 8. Verse 28, 29. We'll start in verse 27. And he rose and went, and there was an Ethiopian, a eunuch, a court official of Candace, queen of the Ethiopians, who was in charge of all her treasure. He had come to Jerusalem to worship, and was returning, seated in his chariot. He was reading the prophet Isaiah. And the Spirit said to Philip, go over and join this chariot. The eunuch is what I would call a person of peace. He's in his chariot, reading the prophet Isaiah. Would you consider that a religious person? Yeah, probably, maybe. Interested in religion? A person of peace? What ends up happening? So he comes to Jerusalem to worship, reading Isaiah. Philip goes over, preaches Jesus to him. Ethiopian eunuch is baptized. There's another example where you had person of peace, the gospel, and the two together. Voila. I've got more. It's riddled throughout the book of Acts. Acts chapter 10. Starting in verse 1, at Caesarea there was a man named Cornelius, a centurion of what was known as the Italian cohort, a devout man who feared God with all his household, gave alms generously to the people, and prayed continually to God. Here is another person of peace. How do I know? This man named Cornelius, a centurion. In verse 2 it says he was a devout man who feared God, who gave alms generously to the people, and prayed continually to God. That's what I would consider a person of peace. What would end up happening when the gospel was preached to this man and his household? Acts chapter 17, starting in verse 16. Now while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, his spirit was provoked within him as he saw that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with the Jews and the devout persons and in the marketplace every day and with those who happened to be there. Paul addresses here these devout men, the Jews and the devout persons, it reads. You notice that description. In verse 18, some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers also conversed with him, and said some, and some said, what does this babbler wish to say? Others said he seems to be a preacher of foreign divinities, because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. In verse 23, as Paul continues to address the Areopagus, for as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription to the unknown God. What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you. These people here are people of peace. They're trying. So because they don't have it right, we just don't even try? So obviously they don't have it right. They don't have it exactly there to an unknown God. They don't even, they're worshiping in ignorance. They don't know. But Paul's going to sort it out. The point is that he found people that were trying, that understood that there was something greater than themselves. We have to find these people of peace. These are just some examples that we can look at in God's Word. Muslims are everywhere. It's our duty. It's not their duty to seek us out. It's our duty. I cannot drive that home more than anything. You cannot sit on the corner of the road and expect that people are going to walk up to you, smack you in the face with a Bible and say, "Teach me what this says." And you don't need to go smack them in the face with a Bible. But it's our duty to seek these people out and teach them. To build relationships with them. These people of God or people of peace are no different than anyone else in our country. You want to know why my family came to this country? You'll be shocked. I'm sure you've never heard this. Freedom of religion, opportunity, a chance to raise a family, to give their kids a chance to go to college, to make more than 50 dinars a month. America, the land of opportunity, the home of the free and the brave. How many times have you heard that story? I'm sure almost everybody's ancestors here. That's the reason why they came. We had to go to America. Ah, no, people want to come here. You all understand that story. These people that are coming that are Muslim, it's the same thing. It's the exact same thing. They're coming here for the same things that you value. They're no different than you and I in so many ways. They just need to be shown the truth. So considering then that they're around us in our jobs and our communities, we need to build relationships. We need to become friends with these people. Go play golf. Join a bowling league. Go knit with them. Cook. Muslim women, they love to cook. Arabic women, they love to cook. They're very good at it. Build a friendship with these people. And I'll give you an insider's tip. Building a friendship with a Muslim is no different than building a friendship with anybody. It's no different. The same things that you value are the same things that they value. You know what else Muslims value? Family. Do you value family? I think you do. You know what else they value? Faith. You know what else they value? Integrity. Loyalty. Are any of these things that we value? I don't even know all of you in depth, and I know that you value these things. Because I've literally spent a couple minutes each day with all of you. It's easy to know. And if you are someone who's interested in God, then those are things that you value deeply. We'll talk more about that. But in order to take this next step, you have to really invest some time in that and finding these people of peace and building a friendship. So you might say, okay, I found a Muslim. Congratulations. How do I set up a Bible study? At this point, you've obviously realized the importance of reaching out to these people. Now you're ready to start a Bible study. I'll tell you two things. I'm going to tell you a lot of things, but let me quickly mention honor and shame to you. It's very important. Honor and shame. Muslim cultures in general are very much based on those two things. I remember being raised and being told, you know, son, either you bring honor to our family or you bring shame to our family's name. There is no in between. Either people hear the Al-Safir name and will be honored, or they hear the Al-Safir name and it'll be shame because of what you decide to do or not do. That speaks very much to what we have discussed already in terms of how important it is that we are not hypocrites. As Christians, we cannot afford to bring shame on ourselves. What I mean more specifically is that we have to practice what we preach. It's absolutely detrimental to our cause when people see us doing things that we should not be doing. We can't be out Saturday night carrying on. Can't do that. They notice these things. You know what they say? These people bring shame to their faith and their family. We can't dress modestly today and then we're out wearing whatever we want on Tuesday. We can't do that. We have to be diligent. That was one of the most contentious points for me, trying to study the gospel. Living the right way is very crucial in terms of our salvation, but it's also crucial in terms of evangelism. Again, consider the Western culture, how it's viewed. Remember we talked about this yesterday? We're the country that produces all the bad music. We're the country that produces all the bad movies. And remember what this country is, or what it used to be, or what it never really has been, but you know, people like to say it, a Christian nation. So they're going, oh, look at that Christian nation. Look at all the stuff they're producing over there. That's a Christian nation? So when they do come across a real follower of Christ, we've got to be on it. We can't afford to miss. So how can you approach a Muslim about a study? It's very simple. It requires a little bit of courage, a little bit of intellect. You've already created a friendship, right? That was step one. Meet these people, build a friendship. So remember that they're your friends and treat them as such. The topic of religion should be common. If you are living a life for Christ, to talk to someone about religion should be very easy and should be natural and frankly should already be happening. People should know that you're a Christian. People should know where you worship. People should know the address because you've invited them. People should know that you pray before you eat. That your kids, you know, I'm teaching my kids to pray before bed right now or whatever. People should know these things. They should know these things about you. And guess what? That's what they're doing too. That's exactly what they're doing too. In the life of a faithful Christian or Muslim, the topic of religion should come up often in our lives. It's better to start with these similarities rather than the differences. Have you ever gone to a Bible study? I remember I did this, my first Bible study. This was a train wreck. I went to study with this girl, and I went straight to the differences. Well, let's talk about the differences between this faith and this one. And I just blew it right out the door. Start with the similarities. I've never done that again. Start with the similarities. Remember, the conversation should be easy because there should be a lot of similarities. And there are. Family, integrity. The Bible clearly calls for holiness, righteousness, and prayer. The Quran calls for that too. The Bible stresses the importance of family. The Quran stresses that too. These are commonalities that we should focus on. You know, your kids, if you're raising kids and they're around the same age, it doesn't matter what faith they come from, right? They're probably dealing with the same things, and you're probably dealing with some of the same things as parents. It's just natural. We can talk about the differences later, but first, focus on the similarities. Once you've established some common ground and some similarities, you'll see what you see in a natural friendship. So when you and I start talking, and we start spending some time together, and we realize that we have a lot of things in common, you know what starts to happen? We start to trust each other. We find a deeper respect for each other. So the way that my dad and our relationship has been repaired is not because I'm a Christian and all of a sudden he gets it. It's because he realizes the way that I live my life, I'm actually really trying to please God. And although my dad doesn't agree necessarily in the way in which I've done it, he respects it. He appreciates that. So it's rebuilt the bridge. You'll remove these barriers when you grow trust and respect for somebody. It's no different than any other friendship. How many of you have friends? Probably all of you. How many have best friends? Probably all of you. How many of you have more than two or three best friends? Probably not many of you. Why? Because with those people, you've established that common ground and you've built a trust and respect for each other that's special. Is it because they're a Christian? I know lots of Christians, not all of them are my best friend. We have to show them that we're set apart. We are the called, literally the called out ones, Ecclesia. We are called out. We are set apart by God. We can show them this in the way that we live our lives, in the way that we treat them. And from this point, you can lead to bringing scriptures into play. Once a Muslim knows that they would be safe, that they would be comfortable, they might open up. I can tell you from my experience, once I knew that I was talking to somebody, Sarah, my wife, Josiah Peeler, Jason Longstreth, once I knew that those three human beings, those are the only three people that I studied with, because those were the only three people that I felt safe around. No pun intended. I felt comfortable. I felt like I could trust them. I felt like I could ask questions about the Bible, things that really bothered me, and they wouldn't take offense. I felt like I could ask questions about Christians, and they wouldn't take offense. Their temperament was excellent. They were trustworthy, and I don't know how they actually felt. I don't know how they felt on the inside. But the way they treated me would have been like the same way they treated their kids, or their friends, or their brothers. They treated me with such an immense amount of love and care. That made all the difference. We haven't even mentioned a scripture yet of how we might show them something. That's what we're going to do next. But before you can even get there, these people have to know that they can trust you. These people have to know that you're not going to judge them. These people have to know that you don't think that they're, you know, going to do something terrible. So maybe now at this point, you have a little bit of a study going, and you should, because you've been talking about maybe some of the things that you do in your faith. You know, yeah, we go to church at whatever on Sunday. Oh, yeah, we go on Friday to the mosque. Why is that? And you're kind of going back and forth. So you've established the trust, respect, a little bit of knowledge about their faith and about them personally. These are the basic building blocks. This is the DNA to a successful study with a Muslim. So you're ready to go to the scriptures now. Now you're ready to say, okay, I'm ready to open the Bible. I don't know, though. I mean, where do I start? Do I go to the New Testament? I start in the Old Testament? Start somewhere in the middle? It's a very interesting question. And I'll say, again, this is just my opinion. So you can start wherever you want. There's no rule on this. But, you know, I can give you my opinion, my perspective. You would be surprised. The Old Testament, again, is mentioned in the Quran. The Old Testament. The Torah, first five books. And the Injil, or in other words, the Gospel. In the New Testament. So stories about Moses or about Adam or about Noah, these are things that Muslims would be absolutely familiar with. And, oh, yeah, I know Noah. Yeah, I know Moses, of course. These are prophets in the Quran. It's interesting to note that because I think we need to start in the Old Testament. Because of that common ground. And, as you well know, as Christians, when we understand the Old Testament properly, it opens up our faith and our understanding of it in a totally different way. In a totally different way. It builds the strongest case for Christ. Because what you end up realizing is that it's been Him since Genesis 1:1. It's been about Jesus from day one, before time existed. So I would suggest to you, start with Adam and Eve in Genesis 3. Many Muslims, again, will be familiar with the story. Even if they're not, that's still where I would go. But I can't imagine that they would be a Muslim if they were not familiar with that story. And the story is the beginning of what can be a series of very interesting points and interesting stories from the Old Testament. And the story, we know the story of Adam and Eve. God makes provision to cover the sin and shame of Adam and Eve. Now, we don't know how long Adam and Eve were in the garden, right? We're not told exactly how long that they were in the garden, but it is implied that because they were in the garden, they had not been cast out, that up until the point of sin, that when they ate of the tree, the fruit of the tree, they had been obedient. They had been compliant up until that point because they were, in fact, in the garden. So we can just assume that. However, when they sinned, God had to make provisions to cover them. Remember when they tried to hide themselves and cover? This wasn't good enough. God ended up having to make these coverings for them. So people say lambskin or whatever. So people say ends up being a tunic later on. This is very interesting to me. Maybe a small detail for you. But consider, in Islam, how is it that you gain God's grace? It's a deed system. You have to do more good than you do bad. So really, you're buying. It's merited. It's not really grace then, is it? Because grace is unmerited favor. The scales, they say. You have to do more good than bad. So basically, you have to do more good things than you do bad things, and then you get saved in Islam. Well, what this story shows, in Adam and Eve, that a lifetime of good, however long that was there in the garden doing good, however long that was, I don't know. But that lifetime of good, they sinned once, and they were cast out. What it shows is that no matter how much good you do, when you sin, only God's provision can save you then. There is nothing that you and I can do to make up for the sin that the sinful people that we were. Christ had to come. We couldn't do it. We were, the Jews were left to themselves, right? They couldn't do it. They had the law. They couldn't fulfill it. Only God's provision could properly cover Adam and Eve. Now, when you tell that and you think about the deed system, that blows a huge hole in that. Because the whole system is based on how much good they do, not God's provision. Consider the story of Noah in Genesis 6. Again, Noah's a prophet in Islam. This is a story that they will well know. It's in the Torah. He's a great example to show that only God's provision can save, not man's provision. Only God's provision can. So after studying the story, it's clear that regardless of what man would promise to God to do or what deeds that they have done, if the ark wasn't built, whoever wasn't in the ark would drown. So let me put it to you this way. No matter how good and righteous Noah was, he was a righteous man. If Noah doesn't build the ark and get inside and slam the door, he's drowning. Despite the fact that, but Noah's a good guy. Yeah. That's why he was given the foreknowledge to know what was going to happen and how to build it. But just because he was a good guy doesn't mean that he was going to get an oxygen mask when the water reached over the mountains. Only God's provision would save Noah and his family. Noah's righteousness would not save him alone. Think about the deed system. We're talking about a good man. We're talking about a righteous man, Noah. If anybody gets to outweigh the scales of good and bad, it's people like Moses. It's people like Noah, right? They must have done such little bad to how much good they did to be called righteous. doesn't build the ark, doesn't get in, it's over. No matter how good he was. Only God's provision would matter. What about Moses and the Passover in Exodus 34? You can study the Passover story. And again, what we end up seeing is the exact same pattern that blows such a huge hole in this deed system. An innocent sacrifice had to be made to God. That innocent blood of the lamb had to be applied to the door of every house. Or what would happen? The eldest son would die. Think about that for a second. You probably had some people in these homes. I don't know how many. You probably had some people who were pretty good people. Who probably done more good than they did bad. And let me tell you something. If that blood, that innocent blood of the lamb was not on that doorpost, it didn't matter how good you were. The eldest son was done. You know why? Because only God's provision saves. Not mine, not yours, not anybody else's. Just God's. No previous good deeds would change the outcome of what was going to happen. And interestingly enough, you go to Isaiah 53 with them, and you say, here's God's provision, foretold, for me, for you, for everybody. This is the innocent lamb that would be slain. This is God's provision for all mankind. And if they believe, as they say, in the Injil, which is Arabic for gospel, and they omit parts of the gospel, they say some of it's wrong, some of it's been corrupted by Christians, so on and so forth, but they believe in Jesus. If they in fact believe in the Injil, and you can go and study the Injil, the gospel, after you're studying these stories to make the point that only God's provision would save, well, we end up seeing God's provision for everybody, for all of us. Jesus Christ on the cross. The most pure and unblemished, righteous, blameless, without sin, sacrifice. The Father's provision, sending the Son. So then you can take the study as yours. You can do what you want with it from there. But now you have proven that I'm just not good enough to get it done. I can't do it myself. You know, I'll give you this example too that I thought about. This is a side note. But I started thinking about the deed system a lot when I was 16, 17, 18. I was pretty concerned. Have I done more good than bad? I don't know. So I pulled out the notebook that I have in my back pocket where I marked down every good deed and every bad deed. Who does that? Do you write it down every time you help some lady with her groceries to the car? And every time you cut off a guy on the highway, you write it down on the bad column? Every time you do the dishes before your wife gets home, you write it in the good column? Every time that you put a dish in there really, really late at night after she just got done cleaning the sink, you write it in the bad column? How do you track this stuff? How do you know where you stand with God? I don't know. This is why I'm standing here, right? And not in the local mosque. Because it didn't make sense to me. At that time, I knew that I couldn't be good enough even if I tried. And I try. Only God's provision can save you. Because he has made that ultimate sacrifice. And what a sacrifice that was. You know, you consider some of these great prophets that have been called righteous. You know, men like Job, to be, you know, to have it have said about you that you are a man after God's own heart, like David. What a high honor. And yet they pale so poorly in comparison to Jesus, who is tempted in ways that we just can't even understand, yet without sin. That sacrifice has been made on behalf of all of us. And if someone here tonight has not obeyed the gospel, if they've not accepted that absolute truth that Jesus Christ is the Son of God and that He died for your sins, you can do that tonight. We would love to help you with that. You can be baptized for the remission of your sins tonight. Maybe you're a Christian. Maybe you realize that you haven't been doing enough and you're convicted of that and you'd like the prayers of this group. We'd love to do that for you. Come forward as we stand and as we sing.